So I went back and looked about Job's wife, and I went back and looked at it, and one of the things about it, I'm going to go back to verse 9 and start again there, but 9 through 13 is what I want to read. But verse 9 says, his wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. You speak as a foolish woman speaks," he told her. "Should we accept only good from God and not adversity?" Throughout all this, Job did not sin in what he said. Now when Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all this adversity that had happened to him, each of them came from his home. They met together to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they looked from a distance, they could barely recognize him. They wept aloud, and each man tore his robe and threw dust into the air and on his head. Then they sat on the ground with him 7 days and nights, but no one spoke a word to him because they saw that his suffering was very intense. All right, there's a lot about this that we can really unpack when we're talking about this, but the one thing I want to do is go back to Job's wife for a minute. I'm tying her in to the three friends for a purpose. But I want to clarify something I said, I guess it would have been this past Wednesday. And that is that I wasn't saying necessarily, it's hard to tell where Job's wife stands in the midst of all this. Now, if I go on into the book of Job a little bit and go to verse chapter 19, verse 17, I believe it is. It says, "My breath is offensive to my wife, and my own family finds me repulsive." Now, if we look at the entirety of what is here, Job is going through this mentality of his family is rejecting him, and because of that and some of the things that are said later in the book of Job, it leads us to believe that Job's wife maybe was not the most understanding, maybe was not the nicest to Job. That is not a shot at Job's wife's character. That's given the circumstance. And I want to clarify a little bit because I wanted to go back and look at that before I go any farther and really embrace part of it. And that is that there's two ways to react to every situation. Unfortunately, what we leave out of the beginning parts of this story are the facts that Job is married. We don't leave that out except for the fact that we say his wife says, "Curse God and die." Put yourself in human shoes for a moment. Job's wife has also lost everything. We can relate to Job's wife just as much as we can relate to Job. So therefore, when Job's wife flips out on Job, we can relate possibly to her situation. And the reason that I bring this up is because someone who was here brought up the impact of losing a child to the point of where they made the comment that, you know, I actually can relate very well to Job's wife, and I don't think we need to dehumanize her and think she needs to react a different way. And it really brought my mind to thinking about some of these things, and she was right. We don't need to dehumanize her. In fact, we need to embrace what we're looking at and recognize all sides of this, because Job's wife is choosing the dark road rather than the road to light. It's kind of like Star Wars. It's the dark side in some ways. And I know that's tongue in cheek, but it's the reality is simply this. She's dealing with loss a different way than Job. Job did not sin. His wife told him to curse God and die. Those are the two avenues that we have when we face a devastating loss in our lives. And each one of us can put ourselves in that moment where we had something disturbing that just destroyed everything about who we are at that moment, where we sit and we stare at a wall and we think to ourselves, how can I be where I'm at? How could this happen like it did? whether it be the loss of a loved one, the loss of a child, loss of a parent, or, you know, insert situation here, I mean, loss of a job. I saw an interesting quote earlier today, and I really wish I'd have paid attention to who it was from. It was just something I saw in passing, but it really hit me. It said, in order to feel the sense of loss, you have to have loved more than yourself. And that's the reality of loss. For us to feel the true devastation of loss, we had to love whatever we lose more than ourselves. Because if we love ourselves more, we're going to get through it. We're going to move on. We're not going to worry about it. But to understand that when we lose a child or lose a parent, you're losing something that you poured more into than you would of your own body. There are people, you see it all over Facebook every day, their pets mean more to them than they themselves do. They'll lose a pet and it's devastating to the end of the world. I mean, they don't want to move on any farther, you know. So to dehumanize Job's wife would be wrong for us to do and say, well, she was an evil woman. She may not have been. I mean, she was married to Job. She was right beside him up to this point, but she's now going through the same losses as Job. And I think it was a very valid point that was brought up, that she's going through the devastation of loss as well. And nowhere in this does it tell us necessarily that Job left his wife and tried to move on and figure it out. She is taking the approach that's not what Job wants to take. So in verse 10, we get Job's response where he says, you speak as a foolish woman speaks, setting her straight, again, being the spiritual leader of his house. Job undertook that role seriously. I think it's just a more testament to see where Job is, but I also don't want to take and sit here and, you know, now as the time goes by and she falls farther down that circle and farther into that path of darkness that she's on, it leads us to maybe later in the book of Job where she doesn't, he's detestable to her. Because he's continuing to walk in this road of faith that she wants nothing to do with. She says she thinks God's taking everything from us. Why are you even giving God credit? Why are you praising God? But Job was very, very poignant in his words. And he says, should we accept only good from God and not adversity? And then it says exactly the way the first chapter ended. It says it again throughout all of this, Job did not sin. Throughout what Job said, Job did not sin in anything he said here. So, again, we're reminded that Job did not sin. Job did not allow this to be what causes him to fall away from God. And that is where the lesson for us lies in this tonight is, number one, there's two paths. We see it evident between Job and his wife. One is to curse God and die and break away from the faith that we know. The second would be to keep the faith and not sin in the process and realize that while God is the one that blesses us, he is also the one that allows adversity to happen, and we should bless him in the adverse times as well. We should bless him in all times. Job, in essence, is saying the same thing that Paul says in Philippians 2, I have determined no matter what my circumstances to be content. You know, when he says, let this same mind be in you that was also in Christ Jesus, who, though he was equals with God, thought it not robbery. You know, he goes through that whole thing, determining to be content in all circumstances, because that is where true joy is found. And no matter how hard life might be, there's something in it that we can learn from God, no matter how much of a struggle it might feel like. And that brings us into verse 11. So when we get to verse 11, in these three verses, this is before they speak. So remember, this is, I believe, true Christian brotherhood, what we see in these three verses. These three verses speak to us in a Christian sense that This is how the church should react to things. And I want to point that out as we go through these verses, but I also want us to realize they then become like the world and stop being the Christian example and start being the worldly example for us as well. What do I mean by that? Well, they come from pretty far away. I mean, what we're looking at, excuse me, you've got Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. Now, this is the kind of visit in which Job's three friends paid him. They got news of what Job was going through. They got news of the troubles. The best example I can give of this is when somebody passes away and everybody congregates at their home. When trouble strikes and everybody goes to that person's home, we've all been there, probably on both ends of it. We've been there when we've received the friends, and we've been there as the friends that are going. But either way, there's the moment where when you go and sit with somebody shortly after someone's death, no one knows what to say, and they sit there in silence. They sit there in utter disbelief. We've all been there. You don't know what to say to the person. You just go and be with them. If they feel the need to talk to you, you let them talk. If not, you sit in silence and you just sit. And, you know, this would have been a situation where, now, before I get any farther in this does call them Job's three friends. Now, I'm going to take that for face value and say they are friends of Job. But what we look at here is that Job, being the man that he was, it's likely the entire region, the entire nation may have even heard about Job's misfortunes, about the situation that just had taken place, that Job just lost everything, including his family. And as we go into the book of Job, what we're going to recognize also is that some who were the enemies of Job even triumph in this. I mean, we talked about the fact that his animals were stolen by two different groups of people. They may even triumph in the misfortunes of Job because of the situation. But his friends concerned himself for Job, and they traveled to see Job. It wasn't like they were just down the road. These men traveled. It tells you where they were from. And in a little bit, we will actually come across a fourth friend who maybe was traveling from a different direction or a different distance. The other three met and then came together. And that's what the story we get from this is. But these three are said to be his friends. In other words, we can look at them as intimate acquaintances. They're not just passersby. They're not just people he had in a business relationship. These are men that Job trusted, and they trusted Job. They had a friendship. We have that here. You know, everyone in this church, I think, would be considered friends. And we would visit. You know, it would be like if trouble befalls one of us, everyone else showing up. I mean, that's kind of the situation you're looking at. Now, the fourth person that we see later in the book of Job is Elihu. And whether he was as a friend or just showed up to assess the situation, you know, we can look at that later. But these three are actually said to be his friends. And they seem to be wise. They seem to be good men. They seem to be trying to help just like any friend would, even in the things they say. But we're all going to see that we relate in many ways to the things they say. We're also going to see that we relate to Job while they're saying the things that they say. There's a lot of things about the book of Job that relate to us as human beings. hopefully, as we go through this, I'm going to find a way when we go through the speeches to do them one at a time and not necessarily try to break them down verse by verse unless we have to. But I do want us to look at just these three verses tonight, where we look at this situation and it says that these three come, they heard about all this adversity that had happened to him. Each of them came from his home and they met together to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. They do the friend thing. They go to meet with Job. And this is in, you're talking one of the most prosperous men the world has ever seen. He's got everything going for him. I mean, we know that from the conversations between Satan and God. And if these men were equals with Job, they didn't have necessarily jealousy for him. It doesn't seem like they were maybe necessarily inferior to him. And he didn't have a feeling toward them of this either. Like it seems like a genuine friendship. And the comfort of this lies in the fact that they left their home to come and see Job. And now, if we want to break this down a little more, I'm going to tell you who these people were. Eliphaz was a Temanite from Teman. He would have been the grandson of Esau. If we go back through the book of Genesis and look at some of the things that are there, there's a tying this stuff together. He fits into that storyline. Genesis 36:11, we actually see what I'm talking about here. Now, remember, this is just me studying and trying to figure out, but it says, these are the names of Esau's sons: Eliphaz, the son of Esau's wife, Adah, and Reuel, son of Esau's wife, Basemath. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gadam, and Kenaz. So Teman would have been the land named after the grandson of Esau. So he would have come from Teman. So likely from that line as well, because typically you lived where your family, and you were known by your family. This was almost like last names for us. Everybody knows Nicholas and Blake as Stanley because their dad's last name is Stanley, and it comes from that line. Same with the Buchanans or the Banners or the Greens. They know you based on the line that you come from. Now, Eliphaz here would have been the son of Esau's wife, Adah. That is not, I don't believe this is the same Eliphaz because that's the father of Teman. We're talking Eliphaz later in the line, but Teman would have been the grandson of Esau. Now, Bildad is from Shua, or the if we look at that, the Shuhite. This is probability here. Bildad would have come from the line of Abraham, but not from Isaac. He would have come from the line of Abraham, by Keturah, which was after Sarah. Shuhah would have been Abraham's son by Keturah. So after Ishmael, after Isaac. And that's Genesis 25, 2. And then Zophar is thought by some to be the name of Zepho, who was also a descendant of Esau. The reason I bring this up is because of the fact that these men had wisdom, piety, a lot of grace and prestige, but these men all descend from the lines not of the chosen, according to the tradition. It was, God chose Isaac, God chose Jacob. That's the line it came through. You're talking one man came from, it would have been from one of the uncles of Jacob and Esau, and the other two come from the line of Esau. So you're talking about three men who already have a bitterness toward God anyway, because I'm sure that it was taught in their families. They would have been the Gentiles that we talk about, because Jacob was Israel. So if Israel is the chosen, you've got that whole thing. Esau was rejected, yet many that came from him did inherit some of the blessing. This is where the door opened up again to the Gentiles, and that's what we see happen throughout Scripture. So I don't want to say that they're cast off, but what it does seem to be is that these three men are from the lines outside of the Jacob story. But they continued their friendship with Job in this when most of the friends had most likely forsaken him. These three men showed up to be there for him, and he was alone with his wife. It's amazing the friends you have until you have nothing. And that's the story we see with Job. The friends that Job had until he had nothing, and then they're just as fine going the other way and forgetting about Job altogether.
From what you just said there, you can get a timeline better when Job.
Well, we can, and that's why they put it so early in the book of Genesis, like 9 chapters in, because when we're looking at the breakdown, Genesis 25 is what tells us the breakdown of Shuhites and all that, but you're talking generations upon generations. I mean, Genesis 36, where I just went to.
This would have been between Abraham and Moses.
Right. So it would have been even maybe sooner, but. Let's see here. Trying to find what I was looking at a second ago. Was it 36 that I read? In chapter 36, it tells about Esau's family, and this is after we hear about Isaac's death. And Esau's family takes us all the way down to, you go through the sons of Esau, all the way down to the rulers of Edom. And when you go through that, Timna, a concubine of Esau's son Eliphaz, bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Esau's wife Ada. Was Esau's wife Ada would have been Timon, Omar, or Eliphaz's wife? Let's see. The sons of Eliphaz were Timon, Omar, Sepho, Gadam, and Kenaz. Timna, a concubine of Esau's son Eliphaz, bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These are the sons of Esau's wife Ada. So you go through the different numbers of wives and the family records. That's just the sons. Then you get down to others as it goes along the way. And so somewhere along the way, you find yourself in the midst of all this. I mean, and it could be that the Eliphaz that's talking here is, it seems that he descends from the line of Timon, because that would have been the first mention of Timon. Verse 25, or chapter 25 here, verse 2 says, Abraham had taken another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Ishbak, and Shuah. Now, every name following Abraham would have been the beginning of a nation, for the most part. Even the ones that went through Esau, even the ones that went through Ishmael. It's like they all branched out and become nations to fulfill the father of many nations promise that God made. Now it was fulfilled through Isaac that Christ would come through the Israelites. But you're talking when a family moved into an area and took up, that became their home. We're talking pre-borders of countries. Those became countries. So when those became countries and that family grew to a size where the small number became a small family became a mighty nation, as we see in the book of Isaiah, you see those families of that great-great-great-grandfather, almost like the family reunions we have now. You know, you talk about the Green family reunion or if there's a Buchanan reunion or whatever it might be, you know, you have a reunion that brings the whole family back together, and that's for the purpose of celebrating the one who gave life to that branch of the family. So, yes, we can trace it, but it would be kind of difficult because we're not given anywhere in this how many generations after Taman he might be that I can find. Now, I mean, this could be just a couple generations after this. It does seem that he would be before Noah, solely based on the fact that obviously, well, no, because that would have been after Noah, right?
Been about the time of Joseph in Egypt.
Right. So when you're talking like that, then I have to do a little more research. I know that history typically puts Job somewhere in that ninth chapter, right after Noah and before you get into the nations becoming great again. So it could be that I've looked at this in a way that maybe didn't, I could go back and look, but it could be that it's shortly after Abraham where you see these. Either way, he's lost everything. It could be that Job's life overlaps there with Abraham. Job may be alive at the same time. It's really hard to put a timeline on it, honestly. We don't really ever see anything that would lead us to believe. I mean, we can go through and read through the names that are here, and as we try to read through the names, we find things that are really it would have all been passed down. But you have Japheth had how many sons? Ham had a lot of sons, and then we get those family lines coming out of that, out of the ark, where you've got quite a few named, and then that's just essentially takes us through the chapter 10 is the children that came out of those relationships of the sons of Noah, then goes into the Tower of Babel, and then it tells us from Shem to Abraham. So we lose two brothers at that point and really follow on one line, because the central theme of what's happening here is for us to follow the line that takes us to Abraham, that then takes us to the promise. So, I mean, I'd have to go back and study it some more. I've just always kind of adopted the fact that it's somewhere in that first little bit of Genesis, whether it's, and I'm just throwing 9-10 out as a reference point, but it might be farther in as to where we get to Job. And if anybody has any extra information, they're more than welcome to throw it out here as well. But it would put us somewhere in the timeline. He was from Uz, and that's really all it tells us. It doesn't really tie us into who his parents maybe were or anything like that. The land of Uz is often associated with Edom, which would have been the Edomites, which gives you an idea of where that takes place. we're also talking about when all this goes down and the family, and these guys are traveling from great distances to come see him. You're talking about friends that he maybe had come in contact with over the years before he settled where he was. I mean, it could be that Job wasn't traditionally from us. So I'm just trying to tie it all together somehow with this history of who these men were. Does that make sense? Okay. Oh. So what I really want to focus on just in the next few minutes is simply this. These men show up from a distance. They made an effort. They weren't just casual friends. I think I've beat that to death now. But it says when they looked from a distance, they could barely recognize him. We've all had those moments where we've not seen somebody for a while and they're sick and we finally get a chance to get there, or they've been going through a hard time and you look at them and you're like, wow, you don't look a thing like you used to. You know, we can think of people that are close to us that we maybe haven't seen in a week and something changes majorly. You don't recognize them. But you know it's them. This is the situation. They are walking into, and they're seeing Job from a distance, and it breaks them. And what do I mean by it breaks them? They see the pain, they see the agony, they see the sorrow, so much so that it affects them on their journey in. They see Job from a distance, and rather than run up and hug Job and be there for Job and say, look, you know, I got your back, they see Job from a distance and begin to mourn before they ever get there. It says they met together to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they looked from a distance, they could barely recognize him. They wept aloud, and each man tore his robe and threw dust into the air and on his head. The mourning, they mourned with Job. Maybe they're family friends and they knew the whole family, but when they see Job, they see the despair, they see the distraction and the disdain and the position that he's in. And immediately they do the same thing. They tear their robe, they throw dust into the air, and they begin the mourning process from afar. They're not even there yet. They just see him from a distance. That's the kind of friends that these guys seem to be. That they, when they hear, I mean, it would be like us today if you get a phone call about one of your good friend's child dying or something happening and you break down. Well, let's use today as an example. It's an awful thing to use, but let's do it. How many people have I seen post about Kobe Bryant on Facebook today because he died in a helicopter accident? Nonstop. First thought that went through my head was, if we would talk about the Lord as much as we talk about celebrities, it's amazing how many people might come to know him. If we talked as good about God as we do about Kobe Bryant, that's nothing against Kobe Bryant. He was a great basketball player. He was an ambassador for a lot of things that were going on right now. I get that he was a public figure. But people being that broken where they're mourning with the Bryant family, and it's from a distance. They're not even with the family. They're mourning for personal reasons, whatever it might be, but they're breaking down and they're mourning. And that's not, again, saying anything about anybody else. That's just an example of this situation where you've got friends who are showing up, walking in, and they're breaking down on their way in. I mean, if I heard the news, obviously news has to travel a long way to catch somebody in a foreign land. This is before telephones and all these other things. So somehow a messenger gets to these guys. So Job probably likely would have sent for them. They would have been his trusted friends. They show up based on what Job sent. And when they see him, they realize the depth of the circumstance. Now it's a phone call away. I call you and I say, this is what's going on. And you can break down with me over the phone from a distance. And we're together in that morning. These guys couldn't mourn with Job until they arrived. But as they're walking in and they see Job, they recognize how brutal this is. And this is where I say that us as the church can take notes, because they go in and they mourn with the person. They don't necessarily go in and start trying to tell him everything's going to be all right. Oh, everything's going to be just fine. They're in a better place. This is a better situation. No one wants to hear that when they're going through a hard time. Believe me, we've all been there. We all know that. But you don't know what else to say. This is why I think that this next verse is where we can take a lesson. They mourned with him. They tore their robes. They threw dust in the air and on their heads. And then they sat on the ground with him 7 days and nights. But no one spoke a word, because they saw that his suffering was intense. They recognized the place that Job was in, and they sat in silence until Job was ready to break. Think about it, because it says, after this, Job began to speak. That's what chapter 3, verse 1 says. After this, Job began to speak. Not before, not during, after. They sat with him a week, and no one said a word. Could we do that today? Honestly, I don't know anyone that could sit silently with the same person 24 hours a day for 7 days and not say a word. I cannot, unless this is going on a more extreme level. You have to catch me with laryngitis to get me to not say a word. But my lips are still moving and I'm still trying. I'll promise you that. But that's the kind of friends they were. They recognized the place that Job was at. And rather than go and try to tell Job how to fix it, rather than try to tell Job how the world would look at it, rather than try to tell him anything, they just sat quietly. That is the Christian at it. That is a good friend for you. That being said, after Job speaks, they then start trying to impart their wisdom. And that is, well, we'll get there. But it doesn't mean that it's wrong to try to help somebody through something. Job trusts their friendship. But honestly, if we don't know what to say, sometimes it's better to just sit. And, you know, there's sympathy for him. They're concerned for him in affliction. When they saw him from a distance and how disfigured and how hard it was to recognize him, they literally just sat. They tore their robes to show that they were with him in mourning. They threw dust in the air and on their heads to show that they were with him in mourning. And then they sat on the ground. They didn't ask for chairs. They didn't ask for a drink. They didn't ask for food. They sat. And they waited until Job made a move. Because we're your friends, we're here for you, but we're not going to do anything until you tell us what you need. Folks, we all need friends like that. We all need to be friends like that. But we get so wrapped up in the hustle and bustle of life today. I mean, not a single one of us could do it. I firmly believe that. I couldn't do it. I got to get back to work, you know, the next morning. We leave people in different people's hands, but the reality of it is sometimes maybe they need that. Maybe they just need somebody with them as long as they can be there. Now, granted, we can get to and from places a little quicker. It's not like we're just riding hundreds of miles on a camel and then sitting down with a friend. We can drive hundreds of miles in a couple of hours. I mean, it's not like, you know, we can drive, well, three hours, 200 miles, right? Somewhere in that neighborhood. So, you know, depending on your speed, trajectory, traffic. But these guys would have just rode across to find Job. When they got there, they sat with him. They sat there, and then now I want to look at this because, you know, we can go through a number of different things that are here. It says they spoke not a word to him, but whatever they said to one another by way of instruction or improvement of the situation, they said nothing to purport that purports to any of it, like nothing to grieve him It doesn't mean that they didn't speak, maybe. It means that they just didn't bring it up. We've all kind of been there. I mean, you know, I kind of talk about the silence. It says that they spoke not a word to him. Doesn't mean they didn't speak to each other. But you're talking about friends who did show up to be there for Job. They saw that his grief was great. And I think that, you know, they were at a loss. They were at a situation at first to, you know, if they'd have gone in and started trying to speak, it might have brought more pain and more hurt to the one who was already hurting. And when we go in and we start trying to tell somebody, well, they're better off, they don't want to hear it. And some people are bold enough to tell you and others aren't. I mean, it gets old to hear that after a while. It gets old to hear, well, you know, well, they're just, you know, some people you're thinking, you don't even know the situation. I mean, when we do the funeral home thing, I would much rather someone come and sit with me than to walk through a line and give me a canned message that somebody trained them along the way to share. But yet that's what we as society have become. And I'm as guilty as anybody of walking through. You say the same thing to everybody and, you know, sorry about your loss, sorry about your loss, sorry about your loss. Well, you know they're in a better place. But every once in a while you have that person who you do relate to, who you do have that connection to, and you just look at them and you say, I don't know what to say. I'm sorry doesn't cut it. I'm hurting for you. I'm here if you need me. And we mean it. And they know it. And that's kind of the situation here is these guys aren't showing up to try to sorry about your loss and then move on. They're not showing up to compare Job to them and say, well, I still got my stuff. They're showing up because they truly care for Job. And so the lesson we can learn, you know, not only from this, I think one of the best ways that we can look at it here is that, you know, they wanted to be there for a friend. And their silence was so long that they would intimate that what they afterwards said was well considered and digested. It's one of these things of when they finally did speak, Job realized thought had gone into what they were saying. It's not like they sat there silent and dumbly looked off into space. They were racking their minds trying to think, if I could just come up with the right words and allow Job to speak first. And so the heart, what is there's the heart of the wise studies to answer kind of mentality. It's sometimes better to keep our mouths shut and sit longer to come up with the right thing. Study the situation, study the response, study the time. And then that way use that time to come up with the proper words, maybe what the Lord leads you to say, whatever the circumstance is. But maybe it's kind of a story of maybe we should think twice before we speak. You know, maybe we should think three times before we speak. In that situation, that's all that Job needed. He needed friends who were thoughtful, who showed up to share with him in the hurt. And it took 7 days for them to finally open a line of communication, but they were there. They sat with him. They mourned with him. But until that line of communication opened, that's what they were going to do. They were thinking about the approach, the response, the things they needed to say. And that's what we're going to go into. The first thing we start with is actually Job's response to his friends. Job's continued mourning as it pours out in words, followed by the responses of his friends to that to try to help him. But we'll look at all of that. But that's kind of where we're at right now with it, is that if we can learn anything, there's two responses we can give in hard times, we can follow the curse God and die line, or we can bless the Lord in their troubles and adversities, you know, between Job and his wife. And then as we go into this, we're going to recognize some of the same things within his friends. He becomes to a point where he feels alone in the struggle because they're all telling him one thing while he's wanting to follow a different path. But in all of this, Job did not sin. That's the reminder we have from it, is that Job's focus was on God himself. It wasn't on Job. It wasn't on Job's family. It was on God. And how can God get me through this circumstance? And the friends didn't have the words to say. They sat and they thought and they thought. And for 7 days they sat with him. But they didn't have the words necessarily to say. Sometimes we don't have to have those words. Sometimes all we need to be is present. All we need to do is show up and mourn with. And eventually a line of communication might open. But until that time, just be there. No one's going to fault you for being a friend. They're going to fault you for trying to change what's happening at that moment. But they're never going to fault you for being a friend and just being there and being available. Any questions?